Okay, great to see you, everyone, and welcome along to Sunday morning for our Lam Rim Chinmay class. We're doing the section on patience, and I think we've got a good class this morning. So let's begin by doing a short breathing meditation. Then we'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. So make yourself comfortable in your seat. So your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed. And as you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of any movements that will take place in your body, from either the abdomen or the upper chest. So there are movements taking place each time you inhale and exhale, and that's all you need to be aware of. If you find your mind has wandered off, just try to relax a little more. And then again, become aware of the movements either at the abdomen or upper chest that take place whenever you inhale or exhale. You should notice that you're a little bit more focused and a little bit more relaxed. And while you are within that state, imagine that the spiritual families of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas move from the 10 directions of space and appear above your head. So they are present in the space above you. And you can then imagine that every other sentient being is sitting surrounding you. And every one of these beings is related to you, either as a parent, an uncle or aunt, a brother, a sister, or a child. And while you've been in these ever-changing relationships, their happiness has always depended upon their kindness. And while they too equally wished to be happy and to avoid suffering, every one of them has never been genuinely happy. But now that all the auspicious causes and conditions to awaken are present, we can form the resolve that we did not have previously, which is to quickly attain for them the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, we're going to help them turn their mind to the truth, to practice that truth as a path, and by doing so, remove obstacles from the path, thereby purifying their confusion into wisdom. Revealing their natural birthright, a state of unchanging goodness. And so we take refuge in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are above us and generate the mind of enlightenment.
Sange chadang sokhi chonam la jangchu badu dagni kapsu chi. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And I'm strengthening this wish and enhancing it, we'll recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then to bring about the state of enlightenment, we need to abandon whatever holds us back and accumulate on whatever will bring about that result. And these practices are all within the seven limb prayer, so we'll say that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And now we make an offering to the field of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above us, thinking that the essence of this offering is just letting go. So we're going to let go of the clinging that we have to our body, to the ideas that we have, and to the merit that we generate. And think that in the absence of clinging, a wonderful pure land arises, whereby all sentient beings can take teachings from us. For this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents of Solomon Moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriyatayami. This offering is accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they smile at us with delight. And this vast merit field begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure. An emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and comes to abide above the crown of your head. This emanation now descends through space, entering the crown of your head, coming down and rests at the level of your heart, whereby his light begins to expand, the radiance filling your body and mind. It's seeping out through the pores of your skin, fills all of space. The boundaries of inner and outer have vanished. A sense of oneself and others has also vanished. And we just rest in our natural birthright, the radiance of the mind. Then recollecting that others need our assistance, we move from that radiance and feel ourselves embodied once again. And we're breathing normally and naturally, and we're sitting in our seats. And we're determined to, through the practices of bringing about our own welfare, helping others do the same. I think that we're engaged in this study of the perfections to perfect ourselves as a means to help others do the same. And now breathing deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And gently bring your awareness back to the room and the screen that you are sitting in front of. I thank you, everyone, for engaging in the preliminaries. And I'll do the share screen now and we'll begin with the class. As you can see, this is class 15, and I think it's the third one we're actually up to in terms of this class on patience. And I've been using a number of different books to help answer the questions, but primarily I've relied upon Geshe Sopa's book here called Steps to Enlightenment, the book below it called The Great Treatise by Lama Tsongkhapa, and of course Kensa Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Tsering's commentary on this section of the Lam Rim Chen Maan. So we're moving into a new part of the commentary, and it's a section dealing with the analysis of the object. And here we're looking at how anger is unjustified. Do you know what? I've got up the wrong class, have I? No, I haven't. That's the right class. Sorry. I've jumped ahead again. I'm doing another class as well. So we're up to here. And there are 13 questions being asked, and I'll go through each of them, and then we'll see what answers we've come up with. So here's our first slide. So anger is unjustified, and there's a reason for it. And in fact, there's two reasons. So we're in this section called On Analysis of Whether the Object Has Self-Control. Anger is unjustified. And there are two reasons given, and we want to know what those two reasons are. So the first reason you're probably all aware of is that the objects, people, are powerless. They do not have control over themselves. So this is basically saying that anger is not the nature of anyone. And I think you all know that people aren't naturally born wanting to hurt themselves or to hurt others. And yet we do that. We hurt ourselves and we hurt others. So if we ask, well, why is that the case? We actually don't want to do that. Well, the answer is, We just don't have the power at present to actually stop it happening. We don't have complete control over ourselves. So when others harm us, we have to remember that, that they don't have the power to stop themselves. They don't have control over themselves. And you're probably aware that this is basically because of the different conditions that are in play. There's this conditioning that brings about the anger. And you're probably also aware that there are three conditions necessary for anger to arise. There is a seed for it, or a potential that's actually on our mind. Then we need an object to become angry with. And then we perceive the object in a mistaken way, whereby only the bad qualities arise and appear to us. And we think actually the bad qualities are actually inherent to the being. So we grasp at that and we lose control. So there's also a second reason, so anger is unjustified. And this is that others are servants of their afflictions. So they have no control, that was the first part, and then it's like, so what has control? Well, the afflictions have control. In other words, these afflictions have more power than the person. to have the other person within their power. Is this satisfying for everybody? Does everybody draw on the same conclusions with your readings? Okay, that's excellent. So I'll move on. Now, there's another reason. They didn't ask this. They just asked for the two main reasons. But when I was going through the text, I made the mistake, first of all, thinking, oh, this one here was the second one. But then I had an interesting dream and woke up with, no, I'm mistaken. But I still really like this part of it. So I thought I'd bring it in, even though they haven't asked us for another reason. They've just asked us for two. But I thought this is really interesting. So another reason whereby anger is unjustified is that when others hurt us, we've got to realize that if they're willing to hurt themselves, why would they not hurt us? When the person most dear to everyone is themselves. Yet, as we know, people quite willingly hurt themselves. So thinking in a simple way, for instance, many of us have known people who probably had relationships with them or known people who like to drink and smoke, right? Or even take recreational drugs. Now, doing that harms oneself. You know, you shorten your lifespan, you can put yourselves into all sorts of problematic situations. So you're sort of, like I said, harming the life that you have. And there's plenty of people that do this. I mean, we've probably all done it ourselves at different stages of our lives. And that's all about us, isn't it? So if we're prepared to act, if we're willing to act like that towards ourselves, of course we're going to actually find it quite easy to hurt others. So I thought this was what this particular one sort of struck me, and I thought, well, I'll share it with you. I mean, this is also within the Lamb Room, of course, but I wasn't asked about specifically in terms of questions. So I mean, this is another reason we can bring towards ourselves to go, because it's unjustified to return the harm of another with harm.
And Eddie, this one's a really good one, because just thinking about, you know, all the substance abuse that we, you know, I mean, I did that because I didn't realize how much it harmed me.
Yeah.
And so it's a great example, because then other people, of course, the reason that they act badly is because they don't realize how much it's harming them. They have no idea. They think it's like it's going to be beneficial to let the anger out.
Mm. Yes, they do. And you probably, some of you remember that, you know, that verse, and sometimes the lamas even say it. They say, although we wish to be happy, we rush towards the causes of unhappiness. Mm. And although we wish not to suffer, we go that way.
Yeah, we rush headlong into suffering.
Wishing to be happy. Now, so we do this so we can extrapolate quite simply. So everybody's a bit like us. Us are great Dharma practitioners, and a lot of people don't even know about Dharma. So naturally, we are sort of working against our best interests. So we, like I said, it's a sort of like a nearly natural, isn't it? We're quite willing to harm ourselves, so therefore think we're willing to harm others. And it's the same with other people too. Okay, let's go back to our...
So these three reasons, I think, are very good to remember. In fact, I've decided to use the PDF of this class, and every morning just go through this. Just remind yourself again and again these things. People have no control. They're under the control of the delusions. And if they're willing to harm themselves, of course they're willing to harm us. So no need to reciprocate with harm. No need to reciprocate with anger or any of the delusions when others act that way towards us. Now, the next slide has to do with a question and whether the answer we give is valid or not. It says, this is not a valid reason. And so what's the question? The question is, it says, I care about them. Why should I care about others? And you say, well, because they've helped me. When I was thinking about this, I thought, well, that's what I usually consider like a friend. This person is my friend. Why? Because they do things that I like and they help me. Bukhensa Rinpoche is saying this is not a valid reason. And it's specifically not a valid reason because you've separated that person out from amongst the vast crowd of people and then forgotten everybody else. Because if you think about it, the thing is everybody has helped you. So to single out one or two and then put the others aside, that's not a good way of thinking and behaving. It says, because they've helped me is an unsound reason for compassion, because the reasoning applies to only a limited group of people who do not have complete control over themselves. Now, these people are partially under the control of their afflictions and conditioning. So they're sort of more driven to sort of help you. Now, I remember this years ago when Kinsa Rinpoche first brought this up, and I was sort of whacked in the face by it and thought, wow. Because like I said, this is my major reasoning for having friends and liking people, because they do the things that we like and because they help us. He said, this is, like I said, not a valid reason to just care for them and not anyone else. So he said, because they have... This also goes the other two, isn't it? It says, because they have harmed me is not a sound reason for anger or hatred or wishing to return their harm with harm. And yet that would reasonably follow if we followed this reasoning here. You know, so if you say, I care about others because they've helped me, then the next thing is then, that I do not care about others because they've harmed me. And that's the natural way we go through the world, isn't it? The natural way that people behave. And yet, Kensa Rinpoche is saying, and the Dharma is saying, that's not a right reason. That's an invalid reason.
And Eddie, we can also add on there that then there's the vast majority of people that we don't care about because they've neither helped nor harmed us. So
yeah, there we get indifference, don't we?
We have indifference.
So there's the three poisons. Aversion and anger, attachment and greed, and then indifference and not caring.
And it's kind of sequential the way that it kind of develops in a worldly sense, that we just don't care about anybody until, say, somebody helps us, and now suddenly we feel close to them.
Yeah, now we like them.
Until they betray us or are rude to us, and then we really hate them.
Yeah, then we switch the other way. Now, so this is why it's being pointed out to us. This is bad reasoning.
So is that because in past lives, for instance, we've been very close to everybody? Is that the correct reasoning?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's like saying that the relationships that we have, we've had all forms of relationships with everybody, haven't we? In other words, we're saying everyone's been friendly with us, everyone's been extended hatred toward us, everyone's been indifferent towards us, and we've been the same to everyone else. So just to single out a small group of people and say, well, these guys here are my friends, the others aren't, or these are my enemies, the others aren't, or I care about these, I don't care about them, when everybody's behaved the same way. So, you know, we discussed all this way back, didn't we, in terms of equanimity in the earlier stages of the path.
And so then, Edie, does this one then also build on it by pointing out, you know, the lack of control that everybody has? Because that's
yes, it does. A
different reason from our personal relationship with everybody. Just
yeah. So I'll just say that what Kinsir Rinpoche says, he says, think about how the objects that we're attached to treat us well. They do good by us, don't they? But the good that they do by us, their treating of us well, is not something that they have complete control over. There's no self-control in this sense, is there? Because these beings are actually powerless. They are controlled by the disturbing emotions, and through the influence of those emotions, act in the way that they do. There's evidence for this lies in the fact that if something in the relationship between the two of us goes wrong, then they will immediately begin to harm us, which is a sign that they have no self-control. It's a sign that they don't have power over the way they're behaving and the good things that they do to us. So this is not a valid reason to have to either have kindness towards others or compassion. So what might be a valid reason? Let's have a look at the next slide. It says here that this is the reasoning we need to bring to mind and become familiar with. Because sentient beings lack control and I care about them, I wish to free them from suffering and its causes. So remember, we in previous classes, we had to develop affection towards sentient beings in terms of the six causes and one effect. And that was because we realized that all beings have been our mothers and they've actually helped us and been kind to us. Yet our mothers lack control and wish to be happy. But this lack of control prevents them being happy. Because we care about them and we recollect their kindness, we wish to free them from the control of the afflictions.
Eddie,
so we've got to bring in this idea of people lacking control. Mifi, you were saying something?
Yeah, sorry, we've got a bit of a time delay here. I'm just thinking there's a worldly correlation here when people act out who we're close to. We often say, oh, it's a cry for help. So we can kind of extrapolate that out to every time anybody acts badly or, under the control of their disturbing emotions, then it is a cry for help, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, this is what that lovely thing that Corrie brought forward, wasn't it? Where we see people behaving very angrily towards us, if we could just instead of seeing that there's an angry person in front of us, remind ourselves that there's a suffering person in front of us who requires our help. And so that'll really help us hesitate in returning harm for harm. But if instead of just seeing a person who's trying to harm us, we could just stop and saying the person is suffering, they're under the control of the afflictions, they actually need my help. Now that would, I'm sure, help us hesitate, give us reason to pause before we quickly responded with harm or anger ourselves. Okay, we'll move on to the next little section. Whoopsie, now what am I doing? back to the slides. Okay, so now we come to these different questions that are asked. And the first one is this, are beings inherently harmful, or does this harm arise adventitiously? Meaning, in other words, sort of, is harm a natural, is anger a natural part of a person? Is a person naturally angry? Or does anger arise sometimes? You know, something we all know, don't we, that anger just arises sometimes. We're not angry all the time, and neither is anybody else. So the first thing we could say, no, beings are not inherently are harmful. We see human beings and animals nurturing children, for instance, extending compassion and care to children and to animals as well. Now, that would not take place if the person was inherently harmful. And so we can say for sure, beings are not inherently harmful. Yet, I would suggest that we forget this when we are faced with an angry person. You know, I mean, we know that the person is behaving angrily. What happens often is when we're in the face of that, we actually seem to see that the person and anger are one and the same. We have an angry person. We forget that the person is behaving angrily because they are within the grips of anger. And so we've got to, you know, once again, try to remember that actually they're not naturally disposed to hurt people. And, you know, so I put this person up here like on fire. He's a bit of a demon fellow. So that we can remember this thing, it is the nature of fire to burn. Fire is hot and burning. If you put your hand in the fire, you get burnt and it hurts you. But to get angry at the fire because it burnt you, it's a little bit it's funny, isn't it? Well, that's your nature, mate. That's what fire does. It burns things. You put your hand in there, you're going to get burned. Now, if people were like that, naturally disposed to harm us, so we have to say the same thing, isn't it? Well, that's the nature of people, man. You want to, don't get too close to them. They'll hurt you. But we know that that's just not the case. It's not that sometimes fire burns us. It's not painful, is it? It's always painful. But people aren't like that. So we can't say that anger and the persons are like inherently harmful. They're one and the same things. So we bring to this next part, we asked this thing then, is it adventitious? And they gave this simile of a sun being obscured by clouds. So here the simile was, perhaps we're lying outside, we're sunbathing, it's very pleasant, and then some clouds move across the sun. And then we get really cranky at the sun for not shining on us. If we were in company of somebody else, they'd probably have a little bit of a laugh at us, wouldn't they? And so, the sun is still shining, man. It's just a few clouds have moved across the face of the sun. It'll be gone shortly and you'll be right again. So this is the same as people. Where they are temporarily afflicted by disturbing emotions. The conditions arise, they get angry, the conditions change and then they're not. So when the conditions are there, we should get angry at the person, just as we don't get angry at the sun.
Eddie, also, Jeanette's just said in the chat that when we are faced with an angry person, we should remember that our own karma has a part to play.
We'll come to that, Jeanette. That's right. So this, as you'll know, if you've gone through this material, we sort of slowly move through each thing, each of the reasons to show why anger is inappropriate as a response to the harm of others. So you're quite right, Jeanette, that that also plays a part. So what I was thinking we should, you know, do by going through this slowly is look at all of these reasons and try and integrate them. That's what I was saying. So each morning now, I just open up that PDF and go through each of these things and go, I've got to try and get this inside me so that when I think that others are harming me, I don't respond with harm. But I'll know that's a mistaken idea. So, you know, don't get angry at the person who tries to harm you. This is, we don't get angry at the sun because it's not shining on us. We've got to get angry. We should be at the clouds, right? The clouds are obscuring the sun. It's the same thing here. We love the person. We understand they're temporarily obscured. It's like the other day, yesterday, I was at the supermarket. And there was this young child, he must have been about maybe 2 or 3, standing in the cart and just screaming his head off. And he just wouldn't stop. And I was looking around at the other people's faces to see how they were doing with this, you know. And the mother, bless her heart, never attacked the child, never went blah, 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 and got angry at the child. And I looked around everybody else, and everybody else was pretty cool. I said, oh, yeah, that's right. The child is just very afflicted. They're angry. Stuff has come up. This poor child can't stop himself. They're very upset, and they're screaming and yelling. As soon as I got out of there, that child just, it was fine again. We were just standing in that line, waiting and waiting. It became impatient and became very upset and then demonstrated that with anger. But as soon as the cart moved out of the supermarket, he stopped. And so one of the conditions was not there, and so then the anger just disappeared. So once again, this question, when we analyze whether harming others is inherent or adventitious, we can see that if we got angry because the harm was adventitious, or we got angry because the harm was just the natural or inherent part of the person, both ways of behavior and thinking would be mistaken and wrong.
Eddie, so there is a comment here from Janine that she finds fear is the frequent response that she has to other people's anger. And so then, of course, because of the fear, then she gets aversion to people.
Of course. That's right. I know. Yep. That's right, Jeanette. And that's our sort of natural response. Next week, we've got a very good, some slides to talk about that, Jeanette. But you might have read of the story of the stick and the person holding the stick. We'll talk about that one anyway next week. But this is a natural response. And so we sort of have to, I guess, re-educate ourselves in a way and go, now what I'm really feeling, what I should actually be afraid of is the anger. Even though right now I'm afraid of the person. You know, and so I'll be like this, I'm the same as you. Most of us, I'm sure, are too. We are afraid of the people. Right, who are possessed by the anger.
So Carolyn has a point here too, that for some people you'd have to use more reasons and logic than observation, that people and animals, that then, you know, they nurture their young, they demonstrate that all, you know, not all people are harmful by nature. So kind of using that as a, to remind yourself of the reasons.
Yeah, and that's what it came back to with the one before this, isn't it? Is the harm inherent? Are people inherently angry? Are they inherently harmful? Because that's what we're thinking when we, like you say, we have the fear towards the person. That's an angry person. Anger and the person are one and the same thing. So, of course, we should be afraid. And so what we'll see as we go through this this week, next week, and I think one more week, there are a lot of reasons put up to show how it's inappropriate to respond with anger to anger. So with the thing you raised, Annette, and you know, with most of us feel is that, you know, we have a fear, so that's an aversion. We don't wish to harm them back, but we just wish to get the heck out of the way, right? So there are certainly fears that are valuable, and that could be one of them, because if you don't be very careful here, you could get hurt by that person, because that person is under the control of an affliction and they don't know what they're doing. And like I said before, if they're quite willing to hurt themselves, of course they're willing to hurt us.
So Janine said that, yes, animals are much easier to understand. And is that because it's more obvious that an animal is driven by fear, whereas when we see at human beings, we don't see the suffering underneath. We just see the face of it. Though I suppose actually, like when you think of, say, really scary dogs, it's not easier for me to understand it at the time.
But you see, this is the thing, that the behavior becomes so pronounced that we think the object is actually inherent with the behavior. That's how it always appears to us. So, of course, we're going to naturally respond as if that were the case. So, as Caroline has pointed out, you know, not only do we need these reasons and similes, we also need to become deeply familiar with them. And then, like you're saying, Janine, is look back over your past and look at things that might have happened and now try and apply this reasoning. Because we've got to counter these natural responses we have of aversion, fear, and so forth. Because, you know, many of the things with fear is either we get frozen or we wish to get the heck out of there. And what's being asked of us here is, in many ways, is to, can you stand your ground? Can you have a sense of fortitude about yourself, understanding this person's coming from a suffering place? They actually need my help. Can I bear the suffering that's going on here? And then when a space opens up, be willing and able to help them. Brings us to this next slide. You know, what else is required of us? So great familiarity with these reasons. That means like going over them again. It doesn't mean sitting with your legs crossed in, you know, meditative posture. It can mean every morning just taking 5 or 6 minutes, just go through them. Remind yourself again and again. At the kitchen table, wherever you are, just take a few moments, look around at yourself and go, that person is not in control of themselves. They're actually under the control of the disturbing emotions. But these disturbing emotions aren't inherent to the person. They are adventitious. Whenever I see them suffering, what they're actually doing is requiring help. So we need to go over it and over it again. Like I said, realize that the other person actually is crying out for help. And in knowing all this, wish to act upon it. So there's a lovely quote I got out of Geshe Sopa's commentary. He says, and this is from Shantideva, of course. He says, in that way, they are all under another's control. So the another is the afflictions. So in that way, others are under the control of the afflictions. Dependents have no autonomous power. So we are dependents. We don't exist autonomously. So this is the thing, anything that is dependent is not autonomous. Anything that's dependent is empty of autonomy. Yeah, why? Because it's dependent. understanding this, you will have no anger, for all things are like an illusion. Once again, it's getting at this idea that when you're in the face of someone who is angry, you've got to try and break it down while you're there. Because the person who is behaving angrily will appear to be an angry person. That the anger and the person are one and the same thing. And that's why we become fearful. Because we then think, this person is actually going to hurt me. I'm like, why? Because they are driven to through these disturbing emotions, through their afflictions. It's the afflictions that are the problem, not the person.
Eddie, this is quite a balancing act in a way, because like using that example with the animals, if there is a snake coming at me, I've got to both get out of the way as well as remember that the snake is an evil, so I don't actually want to kill it. So
that's right.
You know, in the leisure of having all your reasoning at the kitchen table, you can kind of get to it. But in the heat of the moment, this is a difficult balancing act.
Yeah. So I had a mate from my jail time. So he was something else, this fellow. He told me this great story. And I saw this, when he was working in the prisons, these snakes had come out. And you know what he used to do? Sit down right in front of them. And I was just going, oh, Mitch, that's like, that's too much, mate. And he goes, well, that was the sort of bloke he was. Now, he was for most people, was a very scary guy in the jail. But him and I got on really well. but that was one of the things he would do. He'd go, you know, but I remember this thing. Yeah, the nature of snakes is basically to bite you, to attack those things. But you got to remember, snakes attack when they're afraid. Like you're saying to me, when we become afraid, we will either attack or run away. So a snake will do the same thing. They're sentient creatures. They're afflicted. So dependent upon how well advanced we are in our training, you know, it's like when you're in the face of somebody who's very angry, whether it be a person or a snake, you still have to realize this person, under the control of the afflictions, can harm you. Just like a snake, a poison snake, can bite you. So if you have, you know, if you're well developed, of course, we know the story of St. Francis. You know, the animals, the birds, they don't attack him. Why? Because he's not a threat. The embodiment of loving kindness. But if you have like fear in you, other beings, animals and people can pick up on that. And then, you know, they can become reactive. Just as the way we become fearful and reactive when we face scary situations. So yes, you're right. So it's a balancing act. So what you want to make sure that you have balance is trained in this reasoning when you're not in the situation. You know, like if you were walking tight, you know, the tightrope, you don't go out on the day when it's 30 or 40 feet up in the air and start going out there, do you? You make sure it's 3 foot off the ground and you've got somebody and, you know, you get ready until you've got your balance and then you go up and you do 30 feet. It's the same with us, right? We have to not be in those situations, train ourselves through imagination and remembering, and then we find ourselves in the situation and we've got it.
So, Eddie, is this why, you know, sometimes, say, with family members, we can be a lot more tolerant because we do actually recognise it's a cry for help because we have been thinking about how we care about them and we know that, you know, they're dominated by their troubles, but just with people that we don't spend that time with naturally, then we don't actually train for it.
No, that's right. So this is like that. you know, the valid reasoning and the invalid reasoning, because they've helped me, because I know them, because they're kind. You know, right. we just put those reasons to a small group of people, and we forget that's actually the case with everyone.
Yep.
So we don't actually have any equanimity to begin with. So Carol just wrote a little message about cognitive dissonance. And this is a psychological term where it appears to us the person and the behavior are one and the same thing. But when in fact, they're not. Now, the person has qualities, they're not the qualities. But that's how it often appears to us, and it's how we behave. So, you know, a person has qualities, a person has characteristics, a person has a shirt like me, but I'm not my shirt. It's something I have. A person has fear and has anger, but they are not what they have. But that's how it looks to us, and that's the term that cognitive dissonance is referring to.
Cognitive fusion, I think.
Cognitive fusion. Okay, so let's, what else is required? So we need to become very familiar with these reasons when we're not in the situations. Realize that the other person actually needs help, that their anger and bad behavior, their anger, their greed or so forth, means they're under the control of afflictions and they need some help. And then we have to sort of, if we have the capacity to act in a helpful way. If we don't have the capacity, then act in a way that doesn't encourage more affliction. So we move on now to, we're still going through the section of like why anger is unjustified. So now we come up to this thing where we look at another way of, in terms of harm, whether it's direct harm or indirect harm. And what's being said here is whether it is direct or indirect, returning harm for harm is not justified. So when it's direct harm, so the story is, imagine being hit with a stick or being hit with any type of weapon. So the thing that actually directly hurts you is the weapon. So that weapon has no power of its own, does it? It's actually been wielded by someone, and then that someone swings it or uses it in some way which will impact on us, and we will get hurt. And we won't like that hurt. And who do we get angry at? What do we get angry at? Very, very few of us, I'm sure, get angry at the stick. But even though the stick is the thing directly harming us, we get angry at the thing that is wielding the stick, don't we? The person. We try and get out of the way, and then we attack the person. We don't attack the stick. Because we think, the person is hurting, I need to get them. Stick has no power of its own. It's being wielded by something else. So the something else is the indirect cause. And the thing that actually does the harm is the direct cause. Now we come to persons. So the person says harsh words to us or physically hurts us or verbally hurts us. And what do? We attack the person, don't we? Because we've forgotten that actually the person is also being held by something. The person is also in the grip of something. The person, the actual thing that's holding the person, just like here where the bat is being held, the thing that holds the person is the affliction. So now this is the bat has no autonomous power. The person is not autonomous. The bat depends upon the condition of an indirect cause, the person. The person depends upon an indirect upon the indirect cause, the affliction. So you've got to look at like what's, you know, I mean, I often thought of this. You know, people aren't consistent in their thinking. Here we actually get at the, you know, the thing. We go indirect cause is the actual thing that's causing the harm. Or we attack the indirect cause, even though the direct cause is the bat. But here we go the other way. We go for the direct cause and not the indirect, forgetting that the person is under the control of the delusions. So before you go to this next slide, talk about anger again. Does anybody like to add anything to what we've gone through? If you have, just, you know, give us a wave, or if you have a question or anything like that.
Eddie, I'm not going to wave. I'm just saving the bandwidth here by not having my camera on. But I was just thinking in the break that this, you know, not blaming the stick, but blaming who wields the stick. And it really points out how important it is, all of the, our training and wisdom of not believing appearances, because when there's an angry person in front of us, we're just so used to believing the appearance. And really it's the wisdom that supports our practice in patience to not believe the appearances of the angry face.
Yeah, so you know, this type of wisdom is called analytical wisdom. Yeah, and in this type of analysis, we're really looking at the causes. Yeah, the causes we're looking at here called direct causes and indirect causes. And as you're saying, if we realize that appearances are deceptive. It looks like the cause is this, when in fact, the cause is actually hidden. You know, it's not right up in front. It's not so much the stick. It's not so much the person. It's something sort of hidden. Okay, so this discussion has really been based around the inappropriateness of responding with anger to the objects.
Eddie, also, Rachel was just waving at you.
Rachel. Okay, well, I couldn't see that. So, Rachel, what have you got to say?
Yeah.
What would you like to say?
I was also...
Rachel?
Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Hello. Yep.
I was thinking when people are mad as well, sometimes like out of ignorance, they don't know how else to respond to a situation, and that's why they hurt others or get mad or whatever, because they just, it's really habituated and they just don't know how else to react to the situation as well. So I guess that,
yep, yeah, that's true.
I don't know where that would fall under the reasons, I suppose maybe under powerlessness or something.
That's right. And the sort of the conditioning, you know, so that, like you say, once again, so it's being powerless to stop it. You've been habituated to responding like that, like my father was, like many people you know are, then that's how they behave. They hurt and the response is to hurt back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we know that, if we know their anger is coming out of suffering, then we don't want to contribute any more to the situation, do we?
Yeah, because it can just make it worse.
You know, so we know we've, one of our ways of helping is first, don't add any more harm to this, meaning don't get angry yourself. So we know that anger is not the, you know, um, that anger is adventitious. It depends upon causes and conditions to arise. But when the cause and conditions are in there, the person acts angrily. If we can just bear that for the moment and not respond with anger, we can help. So this whole section is really based around us understanding why others behave angrily. And through that understanding, not responding with anger.
Hello, Eddie.
Yes.
Hello, Eddie. It's Jeanette.
Hello. How are you? Yep, Jeanette.
I was just wondering, so are all levels of anger driven by the disturbing emotions? Because I can take Willie, my husband, who is maybe talking in a conversation and he gets angry. He's maybe talking about politics or the union and he's got a certain level of anger.
Yeah.
But then sure. He's got another type of anger where he gets really angry and hit up if I've done something or something's happened and he's wrong. So is the first type of anger the same, driven by the same cause as the second level of anger? Is it all driven by the disturbing emotions?
So there's different opinions on this, and His Holiness has actually talked about anger in a different way now. So what he's often said is that anger arises when you are blocked in getting something that you want. So the anger is defined here as a wish to harm. Right, so like there's two things here, like with Willie's, with the example of Willie, right? So if we go, when you hear about injustice and the labor movements and things like this, a sense of anger arises. So this, what we call anger, is being directed to make a change in a situation. And so then we have to ask ourselves, is the mind of anger present then, or is it just a wish to make change? Because anger here is defined as, you know, a wish to harm.
Well, that's what I was wondering. If it's the same.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a,
if it's driven by the same disturbing emotions, or if it's completely different. He gets very vocal when he's talking about the union and politics.
Sure.
You know, he gets angry, but I don't think he's getting angry at me. He's just getting angry with the situation.
That's
but then
right.
When I do something wrong, right. Then he gets angry at me. Two different kinds of anger. You know, and it's hard to sit there and look at him getting angry and say, well, he's suffering, you know. He doesn't look as if he's suffering.
Okay.
He looks as if he's very much in control of what he's saying.
Yeah, well, maybe you could ask him. Ask him. Didn't say,
No.
You don't look as if you're angry. Are you angry? And he might say, no. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
I'll ask him the next time.
Yeah, why not?
But it's interesting, you know, just I wondered about him.
So, Eddie, just to butt in with that, like with the social justice anger, that's a really mixed bag, isn't it? Because you can have a real intention to change things, but really what creeps in almost immediately is a sense of blame towards the perpetrators, and certainly no sense of warmth towards them.
Yep, so this is something we've got to check up ourselves.
Can I just add there, by the way, for changes that he tried to make to the union while he was active member in the union, he got a $2,000 flight centre voucher. They awarded him a $2,000 flight centre voucher.
Okay. So hope Flight Centre didn't withdraw it.
No. We're going to Alice Springs.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I hope you can take it.
Yeah.
So now, so you might remember or recollect that. So anger directed at people is inappropriate because, you know, this anger, as it's defined, it's a wish to harm. Actually, if you, what can I say? In the Pali texts, there's quite a bit of difference between the word hatred and anger. So hatred is the big one. Yeah, you know, and that's really this intention to harm. Whereas anger is a little different. But the Tibetans have just grabbed both these terms and just put them into one. And we just get this thing called anger. So, you know, you might have the idea, like, you know, to bring about social change. So can anger be useful there? You have to say, well, yes, it can. So what are you angry at? Then I'd say the situation. Is it anger at the situation? So you wish to harm the present situation to change it, to bring a new one.
So Eddie, Janine has said, so is this compassion wanting to change things to improve people's lives?
Yeah, that's right. You might even call it like a fierce compassion.
And Carolyn has a quote here, anger that is motivated by compassion or a desire to correct social justice and does not seek to harm the other person is a good anger that's worth having. So that's from His Holiness the Dalai Lama in
that's right.
Article called The Justifiably Angry Marxist.
Very good.
Yeah. So we're going to come to that. It's the second slide. So let's go on and we'll have a look at this. So we've gone past this one. Let's have a look at the next one. So anger, this is, it's wrong to be angry at people. That means we wish to harm the persons. But how about anger towards the afflictions? And is that actually anger? So the question is, why is anger, when it's directed towards the afflictions, not fully qualified as anger? So here we can see some subtle shades of meaning in terms of the word anger. So the nature of anger is the intention to harm. Anger, it's also a wrong consciousness because it exaggerates the unappealing qualities of its object. Yet in the case of the afflictions, it's not possible to exaggerate or over-exaggerate their bad qualities. Just as it's not possible to over-exaggerate the good qualities of a Buddha. Right? So you can't have attachment towards a Buddha because you're not overestimating the good qualities. And you can't have a fully qualified anger towards the afflictions because you're not overestimating the afflictive quality of those disturbing emotions. Not only that, the anger towards the affliction is being applied as an antidote to the affliction. So it's for these reasons that when anger is directed towards an affliction, we cannot say this is like the same anger that we're talking about when we apply it to persons. And so this might have something to help us when we talk about, you know, what we've been talking about. So first of all, it's not fully qualified as anger. So it is an intention to harm, but the intention is to harm the affliction. This is, so Geshe Sopa in his book says, it is right to wish to harm anger and ignorance. Actually, you know, this comes up a lot in Higher Shloka Tantra, where we use anger as an opponent to the afflictions.
So, Eddie, would you say that the intention to harm the affliction is secondary, but actually the intention to, like, to care for the person is the primary motivator?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's the same thing, you know, when we are angry and we work against our anger. But we are intending to harm anger. We want to put an end to it. That's coming out of our own compassion. Any disturbing emotion that we wish to put an end to is driven by compassion. But what we're trying to harm those emotions using wisdom of emptiness for sure, and any other opponent we can find, we want to stop these afflictive emotions. So is that a fully qualified anger? You have to say no. Just one, you know, the primary thing driving it is compassion, just like social change, and just like when we're trying to look after ourselves. It's self-compassion driving it. So it's not a fully qualified anger. A couple of reasons. One is this no exaggeration of the affliction. And that's what one of the things that anger does, right? Why? Because going right along with the anger is the grasping at its object as if it were true. Right? So it's always got this ignorance driving it and making it so the object appears worse than it actually is. But here, that's not the case. And anger, in this type of anger, is an opponent to an affliction. It's not an affliction. Geshe Sopa says, it's right to wish to harm anger and ignorance. In fact, we should make every effort and use any method we can to destroy them. Anger that comes out of ignorance sees other sentient beings as the real enemies, stimulates harmful thoughts, and is always wrong. In fact, I'll just add something now. You know, there's this great quote that I've haven't forgotten, which is that when the Buddha looks out, an enlightened being looks out over sentient beings to sees what is harming what, who is harming who. He never sees sentient beings harming one another. He sees afflictive emotions harming others. So there aren't any sentient beings that he sees that are not worthy of compassion and kindness and his care. And he doesn't see sentient beings hurting other sentient beings. He sees afflictions hurting sentient beings. So wanting to destroy ignorance, anger, and attachment looks like a harmful thought, but it's not afflictive. Although it is a desire to destroy, it is correct to desire to put an end to the main causes of trouble. You know, our mistake is to think it's the people that are the main causes of problems, don't we? So we have wars and battles and divorce courts and everything to hurt the other person, to stop them. When Chanti Davis says he is going to cultivate anger, he means this kind of anger. He is practicing to eliminate the source of sentient beings' misery. The main cause of our suffering is indirect. It is ignorance and hatred. How can we make these mental afflictions weaker and weaker until we finally completely get rid of them? It's necessary to analyze them and get angry at them, meaning wish to do harm to them, wish to get rid of them. When you look at it like this, then, you would have to calculate whether there are three or four possibilities between anger and the intention to harm. So this is the type of analysis which we've got here, these possibilities. So here are the possibilities. Did anybody try and do this work to try and look out what you might end up with? Were there three or were there four? Or were the possibility of three or four? So first I'd say this. Let's go up from the other way. So can we think of something that is both anger and an intention to harm? Can anybody think of something? Come on, you guys all know. What is something that is anger and the intention to harm?
So going out to kill your neighbour.
That's right.
They put something over your fence.
That's right. There's an example. What's another one? There are plenty of them.
Killing somebody because you don't like something they did.
Yep, that's right.
And domestic violence.
Yep, domestic
violence. Domestic violence is another one. Plenty of that about.
Someone cuts you off, so you scream at them on the road.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty of instances where we have something that's anger, and there's also the intention to harm that goes with it. Now, can you think of something that's neither? Something that's not anger and something that is not the intention to harm.
Compassion.
Yep, that's one. Compassion is one.
Patience.
Bruce, what was that?
Patience.
Patience is another, yeah.
Feeding
the cat. How about a chair? There's chairs and books and cats.
Feeding the cat.
That's right, feeding the cat, yep. So there's a lot of objects there that are neither, and there's a lot that are both. Huh? How about anger, which is the intention to harm? Yeah, well, anger is, you just go anger. Anger is the thing, because they're tied together. Now, here's the one, so we've got three. So here's where we get the funny one, right? So we've got anger, which is not the intention to harm. So the first thing you could say is, you know, you've got two here, isn't it? It's yes and no. So when you go no, what are you sort of saying?
The things that you may be angry, but you don't have any intention to harm. So you may recognize the emotion in you, but you have been able to say, I'm not going to actually harm that person that's harmed me, even though I am angry with them.
Or Eddie, what about, say, a child throwing a tantrum like the one in the shopping trolley?
Well, you have to elaborate a bit more. So you're saying that the child doesn't want to harm anything while they're angry.
Well, but if the definition of anger is the intention to harm.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so then if you don't have an intention to harm, but you may be frustrated or impatient or disappointed or have a whole of other emotions, they wouldn't be defined as anger because you don't have an intention to harm. Is that right?
It's not harm. That's right. That's right. So you could look at this one and say, there is nothing that meets this criteria. Right? Because anger is the intention to harm. So there isn't anything that is not that when it's anger. So that's one thing you could say. Janine's got her hand up, yep.
But so, I'm a little bit confused about it because I think wouldn't you be harming yourself? So if you were consumed by anger and frustration,
yeah,
disappointment and whatever else, wouldn't that be harmful to yourself?
And harmful to yourself, yep, that's right. So it would be, yep. So you could say, so there isn't anything then which does not meet this criteria. Right? Because anger is the intention to harm. There isn't anything that is not that. So of these four possibilities, you could say there's three. However, could there also be four? So one way, like I said, there's three, but there could also be four, couldn't there? Why?
Would the anger at the delusions?
That's right.
Is not this directed is right. at
it's a not
person,
a fully qualified anger.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, Bruce. So this is why it gets to say there could be three, there could be four.
Mm.
It's not certain. We could argue three from one perspective, the first one, but then if we bring in not a fully qualified anger,
so Chris,
then we could say...
Chris has put something here of anger at oneself after handling a situation poorly. So that's that could be both, couldn't it? That could be... actually intention, being mean to yourself, or it could be anger at your lack of skills.
Well, you have to be angry at the lack of skills, not yourself.
How does this all fit in?
I just had a
question earlier about the bodhisattva vows, because in the secondary bodhisattva vows, there's mention of... it's a fault not to discipline someone worthy of discipline, so is the implication there that that's done without anger towards that person, or it's directed at the delusion rather than the person? But the way it reads is that you're actually, it says undermine, punish or banish one suitable, one is suitable, obviously someone who's done something wrong, not necessarily to you. It's sort of almost like from the perspective of a legal system or a ruler saying, or a justice system, these people there needs to be a response to their wrongdoing. And it's wrong not to respond.
Mm-hmm. So the thing is here is like... what's the object the anger is being directed at?
Mm.
This whole discussion is really around the objects of anger.
Mm.
So here it's saying if it's persons, it's faulty.
Mm.
If it's delusions or bad behavior and so forth, it's fine.
Mm. Well, this reads like it's directed at the person. It says undermine, punish, or banish one suitable, that is a person, that's I'm just trying to read that in a lot of what we're talking about here. I'm assuming that it's directed at the delusion, but it reads like it's directed at the person.
But I guess too what you're saying, Bruce, is if you look at the Dalai Lama's quote too, like there's the delusion, but it seems that there's like genocide might be happening, that is the delusion, like that people are then acting out genocide. So I guess the Dalai Lama is saying you don't just let the genocide happen and you have to actually take some action because, from what you said, Eddie, you'd have to take the Dalai Lama's quote in the context of that not being fully, whatever that word was, anger, because... is from what Bruce says of the bodhisattva vows and is in line with what His Holiness is saying. It takes a bit of thought.
So you've got two things going on, isn't it? One is you want to prevent the person doing harm, but you don't use anger, you don't wish to harm the person. So that's fine. You still have to stop the person. It was a person.
What?
It's coming together. You got it?
I've got it now. I'm just listening.
Yeah. So the person has been driven by their delusions. You still need to stop the person, but without anger. But your anger could be directed at the delusion.
Whenever I say that,
qualified anger. Yeah. Sorry, Bruce?
Well, when I look at that, I always think of Napoleon and how he was banished. You know, they could have easily just executed him or you know, done something dreadful like that. But they just got him out of the situation where he continued to harm people. And I thought, that's probably a good response.
That's right. So we've got to try to remember, it's not to harm the person, right? But we could banish them, but it can't be done with a sense of anger. Like you said, you could have a sense of compassion. We often ask, but wouldn't a sense of compassion solve the same thing?
So, Eddie, then what about, say, if you have anger towards yourself or frustration towards yourself? So you may not have the intention to harm yourself, but you can get quite judgmental and get it all wrong and think, you know, you're a bad person or get really down on yourself. So it's not quite an intention to harm.
Well, I don't know. You have to check it out. Are you so upset at yourself that you want to hurt yourself?
Well, it's kind of a self-punishment, isn't it?
I don't know if these are the things each one of us has to examine. I could say one thing and you find an exception to it. And you go, yep, that exception exists. So then does the other thing I just said not valid now? So there are people who want to hurt themselves. There are people that are so upset with themselves they actually want to hurt themselves.
So I guess
there are others who will be this way, but it won't be. So then you say, well, one is angry and one is not fully qualified anger. One is not anger.
There's like a spectrum there, isn't it? Because it's how aware we are of whether we want to hurt ourselves.
Because that's right.
Yet that whole self-destructive response isn't, it's not a conscious one of a right now I'm going to go and harm myself. It's kind of all unconscious and automatic. But it's still there, that intention to harm, but it's not there's no awareness of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's what we're trying to do here, is bring awareness to it, isn't it?
I think that's where that cognitive fusion always also applies to ourselves, seeing ourselves, as the person, but we're not our, delusions. We want to, strike out ourselves at times, but if we separate out, it's actually striking out the delusions that we want to do.
Okay, let's go on and see how we go. So like I said, so when we ask this question, these are always good questions too, so we can find out, the relationships of different phenomena, how the phenomena relate to oneself or others or to something else. So you often get a couple of different things, and you just ask these four questions. How many possibilities are there? So the simplest two, of course, are the bottom two. Find something that's neither, find something that's both. Find something that's one, find the other that's not that. Okay. So we're going to look at that. So we're going to find the actual causes for being harmed. So in brief, it's this: a non-virtuous action you've done in the past. So that non-virtuous action you've done in the past is often called a karma, but be more specific to say it's a seed of karma. So from Geshe Sopa, he says, a karma or an action creates a potentiality, or we can call it a seed. Some of those seeds, substantial causes, have already ripened into experiences, and some of them have not yet ripened. A substantial cause does not yield a random result. It transforms to become the entity. The result always accords with its cause. So bad experiences are the result of negative or non-virtuous actions. And good experiences are the result of virtuous or wholesome karma. So that's the, you know, the first thing out we were taught in the topic of karma. With any experience, there is a direct cause and an indirect cause. For example, when someone causes us pain, the basic cause of our unpleasant experience is our previous karma. The other person is a contributing or indirect cause of our discomfort. Our prior harmful action ripens as a result, such that someone does something to hurt us. So if the cause was not created at some point in the past, the result cannot occur. So that's why you get sometimes instances where you get two people, the same thing happens to them in terms of the direct cause, but the result is completely different. The behavior is completely different.
Eddie, this also shows how incredibly tragic it is that then we are like the trigger for everybody else to our own negative seeds in the past being there latent.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the trigger for everybody else to start making negative karma by being angry towards us or retaliating towards us.
Yeah, that's right. So the next question is, so how does our understanding, what we've gone through so far, how should this understanding affect our attitude? Well, if we're going to lay blame anywhere, it has to become upon our own non-virtuous actions of the past, our activities we did in the past that laid the potential for us to experience suffering in the present. So you can see here, we don't blame ourselves. We're blaming the unskillful actions that we engaged in. And what we're doing, secondly, is do this. Stop anger towards all outer circumstances on all occasions. Those outer circumstances are the indirect causes, yet we're putting all the weight on them. But the direct cause is non-virtuous action of the past. Karmic seed we've got on our mental continuum. It is the experience of suffering produced by those who harm. So the experience of suffering produced by those who harm, so someone's harming, this does not occur causelessly or from discordant causes. So it occurs from concordant causes. That is to say, from non-virtuous actions you have done in the past. Therefore, harm doers are helplessly impelled to do harm by the power of your karma. Consequently, put the blame backwards where it belongs. Say, this is my fault, and I am wrong to get angry at others. So if we get angry at others, we have to go, you know, the fault is an action I did in the past. Stop the anger. Strong belief that whatever we experience is created by the power of karma leads one to stop blaming external circumstances for one's problems. Instead of reproaching others by thinking it's their fault, he did this to me and she did that, one thinks, I'm having this experience because I created the primary cause for it at some point in time. These people are just the contributing cause. And if we've got some background in thought transformation, His Holiness Dr. Kensa Rinpoche says, and instead of feeling hatred for being harmed, pray that the negative actions of all beings will be purified through the vindictive attacks against you. So we bring in karma, but then we also bring in bodhicitta. So the question here is, how are the harm doers helplessly impelled to do harm by the power of karma? So karma created in prior lives causes a chain reaction leading the other person to react to you in this life with a spontaneous, natural dislike and a desire to cause you harm. In either case, whether we know why others are blaming or are harming us, it is not right to blame them. Our own bad actions affected them. They have a prior karmic relation to us. Whenever harm comes to us, the fundamental cause is our own bad karma. Our karma temporarily forces others to act negatively, and we experience the result. Because the harm we experience is primarily the result of a cause we created in the past, instead of blaming the other person, we should blame our own previous bad deeds. They are making the problem. They indirectly cause the other person to act this way towards us. So, this is a way to think of it.
So, Eddie, how does that actually, how can that happen? Like, how does that even work?
Well, if you think back, so being, beginning with lifetimes, a continuous mental continuum, in all sorts of relationships with every being that's existed. Some have harmed, some have helped, some have been indifferent to. And if we've harmed, we put the potential in our mind stream to be harmed. It's a condition just waiting. And then we have the other person come together, cause and condition, we get the result. Now, I was thinking, trying to see it in a term of picture when I was thinking about this and reading the commentary in Kinsa Rinpoche's text, And I was sort of thinking of it like rainfall and forests. So when you get, if you have the rain, of course, you've got to have the clouds. So the clouds move across the land, and do they drop their rain on the desert? No, the desert doesn't impel them to do that. But as soon as it moves across the trees, there it just says whoosh. So I look at desert, no cause, doesn't impel a result. Trees, cause, condition, meet, rain comes down. So I think here I am, like the forest, got the causes there. There's the other person, like the rain, impel. But that's just my way of trying to see it pictorially. Dugar Kinsa Rinpoche again from Enlightened Courage says, the harm which I suffer at the hands of others is provoked by my bad karma. Because of my past negative actions, my enemy has hurt me and accumulated negative karma, which he in future will have to expiate. Because of me, this person has endured suffering in the past and will certainly do so in the future. Thus, we should try to be very loving towards such beings, thinking, until now, I've only harmed others. Henceforth, I'll free them from all their ills and be of help to them. So it's like this sort of thing of, I can see why they're sort of saying, what's the other term for patience? Forbearance. Because if this other person attacks you and now you attack them back, like we see happening all the time in the world, you kick it off again, don't you? And there's got to be a reason, like over here, to come at this, to attack you. If the cause is not there from your side, It's like, if they did this, no suffering would take place for you. But if suffering does take place, you know the cause is there for it. If the cause is not there for it, there's no way I could experience suffering. I think that's why sometimes, you know, I think, you know, when you have two people who've been in a very similar situation, one behaves very badly and one doesn't affect them at all. And you're like, now, why is that happening? You know, one person's got the cause to react very badly to what just happened and the other doesn't. So you'll see the next class we talk about why when this happens, we can actually, if you have the cause and the person directs harm at you and then you don't respond harmfully, and you have the cause, but you're not returning harm for harm, this is where we've got to think, thank goodness this person did this to me now. But now I can deal with it. And you have this, you know, affection for them rather than what we normally have is dislike for them because it's so painful, isn't it?
So, Eddie, in looking at this, you've got someone who's harming you and it's due to your previous actions and but also due to their previous actions.
That's
that they're impelled to do that.
That's right.
So it's almost like there's this symbiotic relationship traveling through samsara, these two consciousnesses are locked into this karmic repetition.
Yeah.
And yet we've got endless lifetimes and endless relationships with all other beings. It's almost like, you know, you're locked together with this other entity until, as you say, you know, one breaks the relationship, the karmic relationship.
Yeah.
I just had a lot of trouble getting my head around that, you know, the difference between, you know, the relationship between two consciousnesses and the unlimited relationships, karmic relationships you have with all sentient beings.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. As I put into chat, Eddie, that it says they're my own bad deeds, but this my is not the me of this lifetime.
It's, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
right. It around like the me that did those bad deeds is not the same as, but not different from.
Not different. That's me, right.
Which is like, it's sort of getting your head around that.
Yeah, getting your head around the existence of the I merely existing, Bruce. The I existing in me and name, but then also remember that the. You know, so we do that, but then often it seems that the karma becomes more real then. You know, so you've got to go, but the karma, these seeds, they all exist in mere name too. In fact, everything does. And that's why it has all these effects.
So, Eddie, can I just ask?
Sure, Linda.
So if you've done something bad, like you've got this seed on your mind stream and you've harmed somebody in whatever previous life it's been, is it always that person that comes back and causes you harm? No, it's not. It's not that.
It's connected. Not required.
Okay, so it can be
a similar situation.
Yeah,
A similar situation could arise, but not necessarily have to be the person. Yeah.
Right. Just can be a similar situation that triggers off that.
Yeah, it doesn't require the same person, no.
Yeah.
Right, so is that when you think about then those the karmic results, so one is circumstances that where you keep meeting people that,
if you just find yourself in weather you don't like.
Yeah. Or in war zones all the time or no one believes you because you've been a liar in previous lives. And
or just like watching television and seeing something you don't like.
It does really bring home that whole enmeshed karmic, everything's karmic stuff, doesn't it? It's like My goodness me, it's like everything is everything, everyone, every condition is like, it's pretty wild.
Which leads us to this last, like you get that sort of wow, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Linda, also not just that, but it's almost like my very existence is provoking others to make even more negative karma. So we've got to actually not just even just be neutral, but actually try and be the conditions for everybody to, you know, to be the trigger for everyone's virtue instead of our default, which is the trigger for everybody to create more negativity.
Yeah, right. And have we come across that concept before, Eddie? Because we did the whole karma stuff, and then I don't recall us coming across this concept that people are impelled by our karma to act towards us. So
That's right.
Come across it before?
No.
Okay.
No, not spoken of karma like this. No. Like, I'm sure it's in there, Linda. But it's not spoken of it like in this way. Was that, you know, in the text, I talk about this word impelled.
Mm.
It's sort of like we sort of force this thing to take place.
It's a really strong word, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
They've got no choice whatsoever.
No, that's right. And, you know, I'm sure we've been in situations where you've just met the person and either you immediately don't like them or they don't like you.
Yes,
you,
I have.
You know,
They immediately hated me.
It's like, what did I do?
I couldn't work out why, but they immediately hated me.
Yeah. It also works with lust too. Yeah. You know? You're just there and it's like, oh, my God. Mm. And you're just impelled.
But I think it's sort of, it's actually in those words, isn't it, is the 35 Confession Buddhas. And one line is, what I have done caused others to do and rejoiced in others doing.
Yeah, it's like
that. Yeah, those sort of, I think, oh, you know, because I think rejoiced in others doing, oh, my goodness, that's a hard one too. Oh, yeah. Glad they did that to him or her. Oh, yeah, it's serious.
So this next slide's a good one then, I think, because it says, yeah, what does it mean to say that we haven't actually taken this on board? And it says, oh, it's not my fault. So here when we use this word I, we have to be careful because, like I said, it's actually the fault of karma. It's the fault of the disturbing emotions. They're causing the suffering that we experience. So be careful here about how you use the word I. It's the disturbing emotions that are at fault. Of course, we use the word I, it's mere I. Because the karma doesn't exist somewhere independent of an I, of a person. Karma and the person are related. Geshe Sopa says, we created the entire situation. So it makes no sense to get angry and blame someone else for it. It's wrong to think I've done absolutely nothing. My enemy is absolutely the cause of all this damage. Nothing happens like that. In samsaric life, the dominant cause for all pain, misery, sensual pleasure and enjoyment is our own previous karma. We should blame our own past actions for what is happening to us now. And in Chanting Davis says, in the past, I caused sentient beings harm of this very sort. Therefore, it's right that I experience this harm because I had injured the sentient being.
Eddie, could I just ask you something? It's Jeanette.
Yeah.
When I was reading the text, and it gets to that bit about the guardians of hell.
Yeah,
is that what we're talking about? You, this karma going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards.
Yeah. Well, so in the if you find yourself in these hell realms, the demons that arise to harm you are your own creations,
mm-hmm.
your own karmic creation. You've created harm in the past. Now, it comes back at you. And of course they harm us. But if you can see directly that they have no true existence, that they are these fabrications of mind, you know, puts an end to it.
Okay.
Finally, I'll finish off with this thing that Geshe Sopa says, is if we do not restrain ourselves, our actions become the cause of a chain of misery for ourselves and others. If we understand things this way, patience naturally arises. The Kadampa Geshe Shalapa said, when someone says it's not my fault, this shows that they don't have the slightest Dharma practice. Now, this subject may seem a little difficult. However, it poses no problem for someone with faith in the Buddhist narrative. When we think about how karmic causality works, that we cannot experience harm without our having created its cause. We are relying on wisdom. Our condemnatory nature towards others will go away. We will have no more active hatred and anger. We will be patient. What a good class. So this brings us towards our end of our topic. Such a good meaty topic, isn't it? Really, certainly has been for me over the last week, just thinking of it over and over again and looking at the different slides. We've been looking at this perfection of patience. We'll go on and do the same next week. We've got another 16 questions we've got to look at. We've been analysing the object and seeing that in relationship to objects, other people and situations, anger is unjustified. And you can read about this from here, of course, in volume 2 of the Lamrim Chenmo. We've got pages 160 to 164. Kensa Rinpoche's teachings were of teaching 3, and in Geshe Sopa's Stages on the Path, we've got 13 pages from 364 to 377. So, thank you. It's been great talking to you. Great seeing you again, Janine and Caroline. Linda, I mean, you know, we don't see each other in public very much anymore, but it's lovely seeing your faces and knowing you're here. You're interested in this topic. I reckon it can make a massive difference in our lives if we can just lessen our anger and be more patient with the situations. So I want to dedicate our merit and that of the merit of others who engage in Dharma so that all of our teachers and all students of the Dharma, the benefactors and visitors to our center and other centers, in fact, all sentient beings, where they have happiness. May they be free from suffering, and may their suffering, indifference, and self-cherishing ripen upon our own indifference. Never separated from the happiness free of suffering, may every being abide in equanimity, the equality of all things. Through this may we become enlightened. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very, very much, and we'll see you again.
Thank you.